Welcome back, Ruby Tuesday. As always, I'm Patrick Ruby of Sports on Earth, and we've got a good one today. One of my favorite topics, and one of my favorite people. We're going to talk about the NCAA, amateurism, college sports economy, and the bid by Northwestern football players to unionize. Joining me is Bomani Jones, who you might know from the ESPN show Highly Questionable, but who I know from our days working together at the departed and mostly unlamented ESPN.com page 2. Bomani, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Patrick, how are you?
I'm great, man. It's been a long time. I've always wanted to get you on. Last week's news is a good opportunity. The big news, Regional Board of the National Labor Relations Board rules that Northwestern football players are, in fact, employees, not quote-unquote student athletes. What was your reaction to this?
Well, I thought it was a pretty big blow to the rhetoric. Like, that was key, is that we're all kind of programmed to say this student-athlete thing. Like, even after we find out what a con it is, that's just in the lexicon. Like, you say student-athlete. They basically said, nah, that's not what it is. And the most telling thing, I thought, in what we saw from them was discussing the breakdown in time. They're like, they spend way more time playing football than they do on their studies.
Yeah. Wasn't that incredible? I mean, training camp alone, it was like 50, 60 hours a week. During the season, it was like 40 to 50 hours. Even in the off season, it was like 20 to 25 hours.
Yeah, it reaffirmed something that I think has been interesting about the recent groundswell of scrutiny toward this amateurism model, is that people who watch sports are just kind of accustomed to this, and this is kind of the trade that we've been told that you have to make to have these games. People who do not have a vested interest in sports look at this and are like, oh my gosh, this is insane. Like, I went to a symposium at Santa Clara University. I guess this was last year that I went for that, or it was the end of 2012, and one of the guys that's in high up at Google was there, and he did a presentation that just did an analysis.
Was this David Drummond, like,
yes,
your chief
was.
Lawyer? Yeah, go on, because I've seen this. Go for it.
Yeah, and he basically just kind of spelled it out, like, what if we use this model on any other academic venture, and just spelled out the absurdity of what it was. And I talked to him afterward, and he was just so floored that anybody in the world would ever believe this. Like, people who are not indoctrinated into this stuff really look at it like, yo, this is crazy.
It is. You're so right. I mean, all of us who care about sports, like, we just grow up, like, sort of breathing this. We sort of absorb this NCAA propaganda by osmosis, almost. Like you said, I'm so glad you brought the term student athlete. I refuse to use it. I only use it in quotation marks. I always say college athletes, because student athlete's a legal fiction that was created to avoid paying workers' comp. And you know, that's from the guy who basically created the NCAA, Walter Byers. Not from me. I'm not the person who said that. That's just historical fact. So I think all of us, the first step is just stop using that term. But the other thing I'm glad you brought was the amount of time, because there's another one of these really funny NCAA quirks. I'm sure you noticed this, but there's something called, and this is a classic NCAA bureaucratic term, countably athletic-related activity. Did you see that part?
Yes.
Which basically means these are the hours that we as the NCAA actually count as hours you're spending on sports, because we care so much about education, we limit these college athletes to, I don't know, something like 20 or 30 hours a week or something like that. Supposedly there are limits. But here's the thing with these countable athletic-related activity hours. If you look at, and this was in the ruling, if you look at the typical road game for Northwestern, so they get on they go to breakfast at 8 a.m., they get on a bus at 10 a.m., this is on a Friday morning, they go to Michigan, they have their walkthroughs, their workouts, their meetings, their team dinner, all that stuff. They get up the next day, they tape up, they stretch, they get physical therapy, they do more study, more film, whatever it is. They play the game, they do their interviews, they get their physical treatment, they head back home on the bus, they get home at Saturday night, 10, 11 o'clock, back to campus in Evanston. That's well over 24 hours. Do you know how many countably athletic-related activity hours that is?
What, about four?
Yeah, 4.8. It's closer to five. So it's a joke. And honestly, it's like the abused overtime laws in this country, essentially.
Well, what I feel like is, even if you put this down on paper as you can only work 20 hours, that's completely ignorant of the forces of competition.
Absolutely.
Right? you create a situation where basically you guilt people into putting in more time. The next guy's putting in more time, so you're going to have to put in more time. So what starts off as your recreation effectively still becomes work. Like, that's just what it's going to be. So when people make the argument that it's only 20 hours or whatever it is, I mean, that sounds like a grand idea, but nobody's stopping you from putting in the 21st. Like, if it's going to be 20, you have to really enforce upon the fact that it's 20. Like, that's what it would have to be. Nobody's actually going to do that. Nobody's going to lose their $3 million a year coaching job because this kid's talking about these 20 hours.
Right, and it really, I mean, that was the other thing that comes across so clearly in the ruling, in the facts of the ruling, that this is work. It's not just the hours. And it's not just that it's not only a time-demanding job, it's a really grueling, physically demanding job. I mean, I don't know about you, Bo, but, like, I don't have to get up and go at 6 a.m. to get my busted ankle, like, you know, put the electrodes on it, put the ice bath on it, whatever it takes to fix up my shoulder. You know, I sit at a desk. It's a lot easier than getting hit in the head and everywhere else all day in football, or going and lifting weights hard every single day.
Yeah, you know, that lifting weights hard thing, like, all the time. I mean,
yeah, no, it's an exhausting job. I guess what I'm trying to say, it's a tough job. It's like being in construction where, like, you don't have a jackhammer. You just got to use a sledgehammer all day. I mean, that's another thing I think people don't understand. So it's taking up your time. It's really demanding. It's demanding mentally, too. There's a lot of study. There's a lot of film study, all that stuff. And on top of that, one of the criteria for do these people count as employees was how controlled are their lives by the employer. These guys' lives are, like, completely controlled by the coaches, not just their schedules, but, you know, if you have a social media account, you have to let your coaches monitor it. I saw that at Northwestern, as an underclassman, you can't live off campus. As an upperclassman, you can. But the head coach has to approve your lease, has to see and approve your lease. The coaches have to get a bunch of information about what kind of car you drive. You know, the athletic department has to give you permission to talk to the press, permission to get an off-campus job, or a side job, which you don't have time for and is tangled up in all sorts of NCAA rules. I mean, you're pretty much like, if you go home for Christmas or the holidays to see your family, you have to give your position coaches your itinerary. I mean, it's amazing the level of monitoring and control that goes on.
And the NCAA has access to your bank account.
That's right. Ohio State was making players in many sports open bank accounts with their assistant coaches so they could spy on them, essentially.
Yeah, like at any point, the NCAA can be like, all right, so we heard that somebody gave you some money. We're going to need to go look at your bank account, buddy.
I mean, like, can you imagine if my employer, your employer was like, yeah, you know, you can't work here unless we have access to your bank account. Like, that'd be an instant win lawsuit right away.
Yeah, good luck with that, fellas. Like, that's the response you get from that. Good luck with that, fellas. You know, but this is life, and people just take it as, oh, well. Like, it's the incredible lack of sympathy that people have for the people who participate in these games.
Yeah, I think it's a lack of empathy, like you said. I mean, it's kind of like, well, you know, you're lucky to be out there playing. Stop complaining.
Yes, you're fortunate. Well, that is, I think, one part of this that's interesting is I think that the average person looks at it like, I wish I could play football, and since I wish I could play football, you're lucky to get to play football. Therefore, all that matters is that you get to play football.
You know,
like,
what?
Like, it ain't football.
Yeah, you're right. Like, the hits to the head aren't real. The bruises aren't real anymore. You're just lucky to be there. All that work you put in, well, you're just lucky to be doing it. I wish I could spend my whole day lifting weights and throwing 7-on-7 drills.
Yeah, nobody feels that way about their really good-paying job, right? Like you're pushing the pin. Yeah, you're pushing the pin, and you really don't like it, but you're making like $85,000 a year, right? There's somebody out here making $15,000 that would love your $85,000 a year job that gives you no fulfillment, but nobody feels the need to be all thankful for that.
So true. And then, you know, the other thing also is, again, this is one of the things that drives me crazy about all things NCAA sort of mythology. Is just this endless set of, like, false dichotomies. Like, oh, like, if you love something you're doing or you enjoy it, it can't also be work. Well, sure it can. I like what I do. I bet you like what you do a lot. But there's still a lot of days where it feels like a job, where it's like, you know, all things considered, I'd rather stay in bed today. I'd rather go hang out by the pool, but I have to work. Even though many days I like what I'm doing. It can be both. You know, a lot of things, it can be both. You can be a student and an athlete, and you can make money on a campus job, and it's not the end of the world. You know,
well,
it's
like, also, end of the day, no matter what it is, your job still got a boss. Like, right, how much money did you do it? You still got a boss. And my boss has nowhere near the level of control over me that these guys' bosses have over them. It's like a listener of my radio show, my man Rod, used to always say, we want them to be kids, and we want them to be kids, and we want them to be grown, and we want them to be grown. When we want them to be grown when they get in trouble, right? We want them to be grown when it's time to assume some level of responsibility. We want them to be kids when it's time to pay them.
That's very true. You know, there is a big strain of paternalism in this, and I want to get to that in a second, but I want to take it back a step because I don't know how many of your TV fans and your massive Twitter army, follower army, know this about you, but you have a very serious educational grounding in economics. I don't think it's complete hyperbole for me to actually call you an economist of sorts.
That's fair. I think that I like to view myself as such.
Right. Not an amateur economist. Like, you have a educational grounding in this subject. So I'm going to ask you, putting on your economist goggles, what do you make of the current college sports economy and what unionization of football players or any and all college athletes would mean for the shape and structure of that economy?
Well, I think when we start looking at the economy of it, before we get to the dollars and cents that people look at it, the biggest issue here is the dynamic of control.
It is.
And that's the part that changes the most. If you have some, if we have this notion of unionization, if we have the ability of the athletes to organize, to mobilize, to collectively bargain their situation, that is the most interesting part of all. Before we get to money or anything else, the mere idea that guys can be like, well, we talked about this, and here's what we negotiate for how much practice we're going to do this week.
Okay, yeah, like you have leverage, and so do we. Let's make a deal.
Right, let's make a deal. It's enough of us that ultimately these are all things that could probably be done now if guys weren't scared to death of losing their scholarships, right?
You're right. They have no leverage right now. They're all isolated, and they have no power whatsoever in the current system.
That is the biggest change above all else. The next level of it becomes interesting because I think there are a lot of things that we have presumed are kind of in place that apparently are not, like things as they relate to medical care and the likes, right?
You're right.
I think a lot of us assume that these things are already being taken care of. Apparently, they are not. So you would think, if nothing else, okay, well, the school's got to pay a little bit more money for medical care, more money than they probably should have had to pay, but that's probably it. Everything that sounds like it could be that money would wind up being the issue, and that's what, you know, that this would wind up costing schools more. The question becomes, where would that money come from? Of course, they probably find ways to generate more money. The end, some people who make a whole lot of money is going to have to start making a lot less. Coaches,
yeah,
athletic
directors. Yeah, people always assume that the sort of all the costs in college sports are fixed and at some sort of like immutable level where, well, of course coaches have to make $8 million a year and athletic directors have to make $1 million a year. And of course we need to have a staff of 600 at the Ohio State's athletic department. And of course at Florida we have to build a new $15 million practice facility for women's lacrosse. Like, we can never change this. And so if we end up having to share more of the money with players, we're all just going to go bankrupt. But that's not how any business works in the real world. If you have, I don't know, like if you have a car business, if you make cars, and suddenly the raw material price of tire rubber goes up or something, or whatever it is. I don't know. I don't know anything about making cars. But if the price of your materials go up, you know, you have to raise your prices, or you have to cut corners elsewhere, or you have to pay people less. It's not a fixed thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's been kind of hard times for people the last 6 years or so in this economy. And the big businesses haven't shut down. They just do things a little bit different than they used to do them. And there's some things used to come at your job that you just don't get with your job anymore. And that would probably be the case in this situation. You don't have the army of guys on coaching staffs anymore. The recruit budget might get cut a little bit.
Well, you know what it is? You don't need a recruiting budget if that money is going to players directly. You don't need Kelvin Sampson texting a guy 400 times a day telling him he loves him. If you could just give him a check.
Here's the number.
Well, yeah, when I got my last job, you know, I'm sure for you and most people out there, nobody was sending me, like, postcards with photos of being like, you're a baller, son. You know, they're just like, this is what we're offering you. Do you want to work here?
Like, if not, we're going to call somebody else.
It's one of those things that we crazily take for granted. But it only exists because they can't just pay these guys over the table.
Like, there always be some level of charming that goes on.
Of course,
and trying to convince
yeah.
people that, you know, that you'd be more comfortable here, even if the money is a little bit different.
Sure.
There'll always be that.
You're Dan Snyder at the Palm, taking out DeSean Jackson for dinner before you try to sign him. You know, of course that's going to still happen.
Yeah, and I don't know if bringing money into it will generate less lying, or maybe guys will just take it less personally when you get lied to. I'm willing to let you lie a little bit more to me if you pay for some money.
Right. Okay, I'm not the starter you said I would be, but I'm still getting them checks. That's okay.
Yeah, hey, look, man, he's the trades we got to make.
You know, but I'm glad that you brought up the fact that it isn't actually just a direct jump to money, because what it is really about, I always say this, it's people always who oppose this come after me about that. I'm just like, look, my basic argument is not that the terms of the deal that are going on in college sports are necessarily good or bad. It's the terms of the dealing. It's the fact that there's too much of a power imbalance. The people who are the labor force don't get to negotiate. They don't get to say, we don't really know what they want. It could be, if you look at the Northwestern guys, they're not even talking about pay for play. They're talking about medical, and they're talking about hours and all this stuff we've been talking about. And other athletes might want to get a little bit of pay. Some athletes might just want to get enough to cover the cost of living. They may not want more. Or maybe they would. Some people might want to say, you know what, I don't need to be paid. I've come from a well-off family. But I'd like to have 8 years to complete my degree because it's too hard to complete it in 4 when I'm playing the sport. I mean, there's so many different things that in every other sort of aspect of our market economy we have flexibility with. But because the NCAA is a cartel, there's no flexibility. And I think, to me, that's one of the most exciting things that could come out of this. If you could break up the NCAA cartel and break up amateurism, you know, schools could experiment with different ways of doing this. And it might fit better for the needs of the athletes that are playing at these schools. And it might fit better for the school's needs, too.
I mean, only thing that's going to change is that we don't wind up capping this at a wage ceiling.
There you go. That's really what's going on. We're really talking about price fixing here.
Yeah, price is fixed. I mean, and that's a big deal. Like I say, that doesn't matter. But, I mean, that is a big deal. And you're right. We'll start seeing the different ways that schools come up with to generate, to get guys to come on board. They'll come up with ways. Hey, there might even be a salary cap. With that, which, I mean, if we tolerated in other places, it wouldn't be the most ridiculous thing to wind up at play. You're right. There could be an incredible level of creativity that people come up with and generate and figure out what to do in order to get guys to wind up coming to their schools. You never know. You also might wind up seeing different schools wind up being powers. Like right now, you get a school like Kansas State, where Kansas State has this unreally high recruiting budget.
Right.
And the reason is they have to fly everybody in private, in part, for any recruiting visit, because you can't fly them into Kansas City and then have them drive past Kansas University,
right,
and then go another hour and a half before they get to your place, right?
Right.
So they got to fly them in private. They have to do all these things. Who knows?
I'm just imagining these recruits getting like rendition treatment with like the black hood over their head so they can't see where they're going.
Yeah.
And it just gets pulled off. And look, hey man, you're in Manhattan, Kansas. How do you like this?
They're going down the freeway and they're like, oh, we're here. They're like, no, that's there. We have a long way to go.
Right.
But like, who knows what they wind up coming up with to get this done? It could be very interesting, like this purely for research purposes. It could be fascinating to see what it is that people ultimately come up with to try to make this happen. People are just so freaked out about the idea that somebody might be getting paid.
You know, they are. And again, we'll get to that too, that sort of that knee-jerk reaction. But there's another knee-jerk reaction I want to ask you about first. I mentioned your economist goggles before, but I want us to both put on our political goggles right now. Anytime you bring up the word union, you know, people have these knee-jerk political reactions. And with this story, I've seen what I consider to be very laughable stuff from my friends on the right side of the political spectrum. You know, it's basically unions. Oh, that means liberals, Democrats, and somehow Obama are trying to ruin college sports and take advantage of these poor, helpless college athletes. Have you seen some of that as well? And what do you think when you see that?
Yeah, I have seen that. I'm surprised nobody brought up the mob.
Right, with the Teamsters. Let's not forget.
Yeah, you know, well, it is funny that unions have become an absolute knee-jerk thing. And in sports, they are a knee-jerk thing because people just, they root against the union in pretty much every sports labor negotiation. Right. That's always been the case. It's funny, though, because we extol the virtues of the Major League Baseball Players Association because they are the nightmare union. They fight everything.
They are. And they win. They're amazing. Look at baseball players' benefits and pension and pay and work conditions compared to any of their sports unions. It's a blowout. I don't understand why if you're the NFLPA, the NBAPA, NHL guys, I don't know why you don't just look at baseball union and be like, tell us who to hire to run us.
Yeah, you got to be willing to fight. And they fought so much. Like, that was the thing about them. They were willing to go to the wall in the way the owners were never willing to go to the wall. And it's completely reversed in the other sports where, and the owners know that if it comes down to a work stoppage with the Baseball Players Association, they can do this all day long. The owners ain't won one of those yet, right?
That's right.
But all of a sudden, they hear all this, and then they hear this for, it's like, oh, no. Last thing you want is a union. And everything I've heard about the last thing you want is a union are like these obscure hypotheticals. If they're employees and now they got the union, then they'll be taxed on their tuition, which is certainly not the case.
I mean, no, it's not. Actually, that can't be taxed. It's already in the IRS code.
That's not how it works. I remember when I was in grad school the first time, I got one of those tax forms about my tuition. I was so freaked out, and I was like, wait a minute, I don't have to pay anything on that?
Right. It's just for your record keeping.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, yeah. But, yo, that is the most interesting part of this because this has turned into the pay-for-play argument, and nobody's even talking about pay-for-play at this point. All they're talking about is medical care, taking care of the educational concerns of it. But as soon as you attach the word union to it, no one's asking the question, why do you need a union to get these very basic things? It's just, oh, no, you don't want a union. But there never seems to be an answer subsequent.
Right. It's like, yeah, why do you feel like you need to collectively organize? Uh-oh, and I said the word collectively. That's dog whistle to the right. To have some power, you know? Well, because right now these guys, the power, like I said, the power imbalance is so great between any individual athlete and this consortium of schools. I want to stay on the political search for a second because, I mean, there's another way in which this is absolutely a political story. So here in D.C. where I live, the National Labor Relations Board is going to hear an appeal on this. That's like the national office. Now, there was a lot of political fighting and stalling before this took place, but now also that board is staffed with Obama appointees who are traditionally more friendly to labor than, say, it would have been during the Bush era. I think that's actually a huge reason why we're seeing this particular challenge to the NCAA at this point in time. And moreover, though, there's also a decent chance that this case will then move into the federal courts and maybe in the Supreme Court, which is really the Roberts Court, which we know, putting aside the Obamacare ruling, is tilted to the right and generally favors big business over labor. How do you see the politics of this playing out across that arc, from the NLRB to the court system to possibly a Supreme Court?
Well, it's interesting because, you know, with the courts, I guess that's such a judge-to-judge sort of thing.
Right.
But this president in this administration has used sports as a way to try to show constituents that he is like them. That is why I think he does these brackets. This is why I think he always talks about games and, you know, this is a way for him to connect with people who I think in a lot of cases otherwise believe that they are not able to connect with him.
Right.
Now never forget something. During his first run for president, one thing he threw out there was that he wanted a college football playoff. And it was a brilliant play because everybody, quote unquote, wants a college football playoff, right? It's like saying you like ice cream, right? Everybody's on board with that. Yay, yeah, college football playoff. Rah, rah.
We'll have a playoff and it'll be sponsored by ice cream.
Yes. Like, he knew what he was doing. I bring that up to say, hey, man, does anybody politically want to be the person that helped get rid of the college sports?
You're right.
That is something that I've wondered about this from jump. I've always said that whatever changes happen here, we're going to happen in the courts. And the reason they were going to happen and have to happen in the courts is there's no way that you're going to keep your little seat in the House of Representatives voting against college football. That's not happening. You're not coming back to Texas to your little district after you voted against college football. That's not how it's going to go down. So I'm curious to see, just as you are, whether the right-left situations even matter as much, because somebody's got to be the heart to be the one to do that, and that'll only be a judge,
you know,
the way that I see it.
You know what? That's a great point. I have two thoughts on that, because actually I kind of agree with you. One is, you know, I've looked at the sort of history of challenges to the NCAA and to amateurism in the courts, and it's an astonishing series of judges punting, like just completely punting, like not applying any of the normal sort of antitrust rule of reason fact testing that goes on. Like, they basically just take the NCAA at their word about education, Athenian ideals, blah, blah, blah. And they never ask them to prove that this is an antitrust violation. It's kind of astonishing, and that's actually for the first time changing in the O'Bannon case. The judge there is like, you're going to have to prove this now. And I think that's why that case looks so bad right now for the NCAA. But the second thing is about, you know, like you said, about the politicians. You're right. Do they even want to touch this? Now, Ken Coulter, the Northwestern quarterback who's sort of the face of this, former Northwestern quarterback at this point, and Ramogi Huma, the former UCLA linebacker who is the head of the National Collegiate Players Association, has basically been fighting this battle for like more than a decade now. They're both going to Congress this week. They're coming to town. They're going to lobby about this issue. They didn't say who in Congress they're seeing, but it's a group of legislators. Publicly, we've seen Harry Reid offer support for the athletes, but we've also seen Lamar Alexander, you know, on Team Red, offering the opposite. I want to read you a quote from Alexander. This is what he said, and it might get to what you were saying. Quote, imagine a university's basketball players striking before a Sweet 16 game, demanding shorter practices, bigger dorm rooms, better food, and no classes before 11 a.m. This is an absurd decision that will destroy intercollegiate athletics as we know it. I think he sounds like a grumpy old man who's kind of out of touch with reality and also the actual demands that the players who are doing this have talked about. But what do you think when you hear that?
He knows his audience. That's the thing. They hear that and they're like, yeah, like the silly things that he mentioned that people would be asking for, right? Better food. I mean,
right.
And although I do think that that would be something worth striking for. You know, like the things that he lists.
Well, the no classes for 11 a.m., it's like, again, I don't think he read the decision. It's like, these guys don't have class for 11 a.m. because they're in freaking practice. Their coaches won't let them have classes. I mean, that was one of the really striking things in the ruling was Kane Coulter was talking about how, you know, he had to drop his pre-med major, basically, because it was too demanding. He switched to, like, psychology or something that was easier for him. And when he had morning classes that he wanted to take, he couldn't take them because of practice. And he wasn't alone in that. And that's common. That's common everywhere. Like, so many of these athletes, they really just are forced to major in eligibility. Shane Battier, right? We remember him at Duke, right? Really bright guy. I'm like 95% sure he majored in religion just because it fit his basketball schedule, not because it's something he wanted to really major in.
It's hard to serve these two masters that guys are being asked to serve at the same time. Merely, I mean, for no other reason, man, there's only 24 hours in the day. Like that,
you're right.
That is the one thing that the NCAA can't push, the NCAA can't stretch, they can't do anything with, is that there's only 24 hours in a day. Now, you talk about that thing Lamar Alexander said. The thing that makes that as interesting as anything else, the public is overwhelmingly against the idea of compensating athletes beyond a scholarship.
You're right. There was a poll last week, ABC News, Washington Post. It was split on the idea of a union, right? 47% in favor, 47% opposed to college athletes having a union to negotiate for their rights and their working conditions. But if you ask them pay for play question, 33% support, 64% opposition, 47% of that strongly oppose. Do you surprised by those numbers at all?
Well, I thought it was crazy that it was so overwhelming. Like, it was funny. I was talking to Dan about this, and Dan says that taking the side of paying athletes is the easy side to take. He says, because you're on the side of the majority. I'm like, I don't know who these people are that you know. And then these numbers bore out.
He talked to these sports writers on Twitter. Like, we're a small tribe.
Yeah, like, what are you talking about? Like, no, it's overwhelmingly, and race is a huge variable.
Yes, okay, good. I want to read you some more numbers. This is exactly where I want to go with this. Because when you drill into the numbers, it is much more interesting. 51% of non-whites support pay-for-play. 73% of whites oppose it. Same thing with unions. Non-whites support it, whites oppose. And not just race, we got to talk age, too. Young people, more support for unions and for pay-for-play. People over 50, overwhelmingly against both. What do those two things say to you? I mean, does it literally just say, you know what, grumpy old white people don't want to see this happen, or what?
Yeah, I wonder, like, when you further, you know, spell the stuff out, I get to be a little confused. Now, the thing I thought that was interesting is when we looked at the race breakdown on pay-for-play, I'm still looking at the 49% of the non-white. Like, what are y'all on?
Like, yeah, it's kind of funny too, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's still a pretty damn big number that you wind up with there. But the overwhelming number of white people who are opposed to the notion of pay for play is staggering. Like, it begs the question as to why that is split exists in the way that it does. And I guess that we could hypothesize and throw some stuff off the wall about how the athletes that we're discussing are primarily black, and perhaps it's the empathy question or anything else. But I'd like to know more. Like, that's a little bit too easy to say. That's a trip, Jack. Like, that blew me away when I saw it spelled out in that way. But then I was still left wondering, but these 49% of non-whites, I still got questions about y'all. This ain't gonna cost anybody any money. Like, this is the most resentful thing ever.
Yeah, it is. It is. I actually also find it hard to believe from the standpoint of it does seem to be there's some sort of racial thing going on there, but at the same time, these are the same fans who are like overwhelmingly cheering for these same predominantly African-American athletes on game day. You know, there's a total schizophrenia here, right?
Yeah, well, yes and no. Those two things I think are easily reconciled because people act like these recruits who then become players belong to the school.
You're right. You're right.
That ain't hard to rectify with the idea that they shouldn't be paid.
Right. Right. You know, and that's actually when you use the word belong to something, and we're talking about race.
But whether people like it or not, that is the way that they look at it.
I think you're right.
They do look at this idea as though these players are possessions once they get them, and it's a sport to luring them and bringing them in and having them wave your banner and sing your alma mater. Like, you really think about it, it's not a big deal because we're not talking about religion or anything like that. But, like, all the customs and things that you then force upon players just because they decide to come play for your school. So now all of a sudden I got to pretend to care about this alma mater and sing this song and do all this stuff.
It's a little culty, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you're making me do this. I don't think I'd do this otherwise. Like, this is something that you guys want me to do. Like, I get in trouble with my coach if I don't come out here and sing the alma mater after the game, right?
We need, like, Scientology University to fill the team.
Yeah, but people want that. People want the guys to pretend like they're one of theirs. So, I mean,
it's very tribal. Look, it's very tribal. I mean, that's for sure. That's sports.
Yeah, but there's a there is an element of belonging without having to take it all the way out to a slavery metaphor.
Right.
People do act like these guys are theirs, and he's ours. Like, yeah. Just 'cause you don't like them all don't mean you can't like yours.
Yeah, you know what? That makes a lot of sense. I want you to put your economist goggles back on, because I want to stick with race, and I want to read you a quote from Gary Becker, Nobel Prize winning economist, University of Chicago. I only mention his school because if you know anything about UC economics, you know it is not a hotbed of social and political liberalism.
No.
So that makes this quote that much more powerful. Here's what he wrote about the basic economic structure of college sports. Quote, a large fraction of the Division I players in basketball and football, the two big money sports, are recruited from poor families. Many of them are African Americans from inner cities and rural areas. Every restriction on the size of scholarships that can be given to athletes in these sports usually takes money away from poor athletes and their families, and in effect transfers these resources to richer students in the form of lower tuition and cheaper tickets for games. unquote. So essentially, what he's kind of saying is that NCAA amateurism, at least at the schools with big-time football and basketball, is a reverse Robin Hood system. And there's a racial element, because it's redistributing wealth away from young black men and their families towards predominantly middle class and above white students and their families. Do you agree with that take? And also, if there's truth to that, why aren't free market conservatives and redistribution haters up in arms over the system?
Well, I would extend what he said further, because I'm assuming, based on the way that he phrased that, that Becker is not entirely familiar with exactly how this system works. Mm-hmm. And I say that because he did not mention the most obvious way that it's redistributed. It's not through ticket prices. It's not through cheaper tuition.
It's through the swim team, isn't it?
It's through non-revenue sports.
Yeah.
It's the lacrosse team. It's the field hockey team. It's all these teams that don't generate the revenue to support themselves that siphon off the athletic department budget. And now, granted, most of those sports are not full scholarship. In fact, I think none of those sports are full scholarship.
Right, they're not, which people don't realize. I'm glad you brought that up.
Yeah, but part of the reason why those sports are not scholarship is, in many cases, they're recruiting a lot of people that don't need your stinking money.
You're right. You're right. Like those are all travel. Those are all travel ball sports. You need money just to get good at them.
Right. Like the lacrosse team. Not all those boys need your money in order to go to this school. However, they sure will take it if you do offer it, and it is then offered. So, yes, there are players who do wind up coming to play lacrosse or whatever other sport you want to name, and they're coming and they're paying their way, but they didn't pay for that stadium they play in. They're not paying for those cleats that they're getting. That's coming off the backs of football and basketball players.
Which is kind of disturbing, I think, to think about. When you look at it that way, and I honestly, it's really hard to argue against that perspective.
No, there's no argument against it. I mean, it's on the balance sheet.
Right.
Like, it's very clear. That's what's going on here. That's how this works. The big sports generate the revenue that subsidize these sports that are often used as a reason why it's not to compensate the players. Is, well, if we compensate the players,
they're the hostages.
Have a lacrosse team.
Right. So, they're the hostages. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so by the way, we want to have a lacrosse team. It doesn't cost that much to have a lacrosse team. And even the biggest schools' athletic budgets are only like a couple percentage points of the overall school budget. If a school wants to keep its lacrosse team, whether or not it has to pay market wages to basketball and football players, they can keep it. They can afford it. They're four drama departments, you know what I mean? It's not like they're talking about, oh, like, we're going to have to pay our football players now. I guess we're going to cut drama. No one's talking about that. You know what I mean? This is all just part of how the current accounting structure is set up with athletic departments. That's just an accounting structure. It can change.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Let's just say you get rid of the lacrosse program. So what? Like, no one has explained to me as of yet why where it is written in this Constitution that everybody's got to have their little non-revenue sports. Like, if the sports can't support themselves, perhaps that's an indicator that they would be better supported on a club level, where the people who do enjoy those sports, who enjoy watching them and who enjoy playing them, can still do that, and you can get you a little booster club to pay for some money for some travel, and you go play lacrosse against, you know, some of the other schools. You won't have the massive schedule that you had before, but you can still have the experience of playing lacrosse. Why does it have to be funded by the athletic department in that way? No one's got a real answer for that stuff, because no one, like, actually cares about it. Like, when you dial back everybody's logic of why they don't want to pay players, it really comes down to they just don't want to pay them.
Yeah, you're right. I agree with you. There is that sort of visceral, almost moral element to it, I would say. I was going to say paternalism, but it even goes beyond that. Last fall, I was at University of Texas. I was asked to do a debate on this, right? So it was me, Jody Conrad, who used to be the legendary women's basketball coach there, athletic director, very distinguished person within college sports, and Ken Hance, former congressman, chancellor of the Texas Tech System, a very charming, good old boy politician kind of guy. You know, I talked to him afterwards. He just charmed my socks off. You know what I mean? I can see why this guy won an election. By the way, he beat George H.W. Bush in a congressional election. A little bit of trivia there. During the debate, Hance basically admitted to me, he's like, I don't want this system to change, basically because I'm not comfortable with young athletes walking around with money in their pockets. I mean, does it really just come down to that? Like, I'm just not comfortable with, and this might be another racial question, with these guys having money in their pocket.
It's hard to separate this from the idea of race, because nobody seems to have a problem with young baseball players walking around these little small towns with single-A affiliates with pockets full of money.
Or tennis players.
Right. I mean, there's a whole range of people that we can point to that no one has a problem with them walking around with money. It's just these guys. And I guess you'd have to ask these people more and more why they have a problem with it. But people will just ask me flat out, do you really want these guys walking around with a bunch of money? And I'm like, why not? I mean, they'll probably blow it, but that's their right.
That's America. I know lots of young people in every industry are stupid with their money. That's what young people tend to be with money. Like, you think you're going to live forever, and you don't think about the future very much.
Well, something like 2/3 of this country has less than $1,000
in savings. Yeah, let's not limit it to young people.
I mean, there's a lot of finger wagging that goes on there. But no, I mean, people just don't like the idea that these guys will have money. And it's a level of resentment that I find a little bit incomprehensible.
That's a word that doesn't get talked about enough. Resentment. I taught a class at Georgetown last year in sports journalism, and I had I had about 7 or 8 athletes in my class, and no, not away from the basketball team. So these were all non-revenue sport. You know, Georgetown has a small-time football program, women's soccer players, lacrosse players, had a girl from the track team on there. And this is Georgetown. This is, again, it's not like big time, big glam or anything like that. All these kids could not wait to talk to me about how the other students resented them and thought they were getting over and thought they were getting like special benefits and privileges and all this stuff. And all they want to talk to me about how like what they did was really hard and really demanding, and it was harder to be a student and all these things. There's kind of a disconnect, isn't there, between the reality of life for a lot of these college athletes and sort of how the rest of us look at them and perceive their life to be?
Yeah, I think a lot of people look at athletes and look at their standing in the social hierarchy, right? And they look at them and they see that, and they would like that place in the social hierarchy. Like, you'd be amazed how many people hit me up about paying football players, for example, and one reason that they'll cite that they believe that those football players don't need to be paid is because they get a lot of girls.
So should we not pay musicians too?
Right, like, yeah, exactly. Like, that's just pure resentment. Like, yo, there's a lot of people out here getting a lot of girls. Like, yeah. That's like, what are you talking about?
Should we impound the fortunes of rich old guys too?
Right. I mean, it is, but there are a lot of people that do have that kind of general level of resentment, and you know, it's almost like,
why are you so celebrated and I'm not?
Yeah, it's like, you know, or kind of the I want to be somebody. And these guys are somebody's like, I don't want to put too much on other people in that way. But that there is, I do think, a general level of resentment toward athletes. So they believe that these people already get more than me already. So why should they get any more than me than they already get now? And I always say, get good at something. Like, people act like athletes are the only people that get scholarships. That's right. People act like athletes are the only people that beat women. Like, that's not how this works.
No, you're right. You're getting good at stuff helps with all those things.
Yeah. Just get good. I mean, people like
they have a lot of work. I mean,
no ability to acquire these things themselves, and that's just not true.
I mean, that's one thing people don't understand too. It's like, okay, to be an elite athlete, like, you definitely need like genetic blessing one way or another. You need to be tall. You need to be fast. You need to have incredible stamina in the pool. Whatever it is, right? It helps, but also you need to work your butt off. Like, most people I know, I don't think they really understand, like, when you're at that elite level, like, how much work that took. How much single-minded focus that took. Like, even the when you're watching sports, I don't care if it's college or pro, like, the guy or woman that you're pointing at is like, that's the worst person on the bench, or that's the laziest player on the floor. They're probably still better at what they do than you are at anything, and they've probably worked harder at what they do and put more hours into it than you have at anything. And people don't realize that at all.
Nah.
I don't know. I just want to get my soapbox there because that ticks me off.
Yeah, no, you can't get that good at this stuff without putting in a whole lot of grind, especially with as many people as want to do it. Like, the nature of competition. That's why the nature of competition is what drives the workload up so high.
You're right. It goes back to those hours. That's why there are those hours. That's why 5 NCAA hours equals like 35 normal hours.
Yeah, man. I mean, it's fierce out here in that world. And I do think a lot of people just say that they would love to be that person. It has nothing to do with their concept of how much work that person's putting in. I do think people just look at him and say, I want to be that person.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. I think the other thing, too, that when you get back to, it might not be resentment, but maybe the ick factor, that like the disgust factor, is some. It's because it's somehow connected to school. Like, we have absorbed that idea that playing sports for a school and then literally getting some money for it is like morally wrong in some way. But I've never had it explained to me why. It just sort of is.
Well, by that token, I've always felt like people need to acknowledge that being playing to win is also wrong, right?
Good point.
And I think that gets lost in this. And I don't mean like playing to win every game that you're in. You certainly should do that. But when winning is the primary objective, which is the case for all of these schools, winning is the primary objective. When winning becomes the primary objective, then we're not doing this for the alma mater. We're not doing this to represent the alma mater. You're just getting a bunch of people together who want to win. And you get people who want to win for themselves. And then we go from there, right? But if taking money is somehow a problem and makes this idea or this notion less pure, then so does recruiting out-of-state students and all of these other things that you do in order to win.
It's a very arbitrary thing to declare that that's what's impure. Like, which, again, not explained. What do you even mean by impurity? It's just like, you should just be disgusted by this because. You know, like, there's no actual underlying philosophical support for it. Not to become more philosophers here, but, like, most stuff that we have prohibitions on is because in some way it's harming somebody or something, and we try to prevent harm. That's sort of, like, one of the, like, very basic bars of morality in our culture. And, like, it's not explained to me where's the harm if someone has a campus job and it happens to be playing sports. Because when I worked at the bookstore at Georgetown, I was paid for that. It didn't affect my ability to be a student. And it was nobody looked at me and said, like, but aren't you an amateur?
Right.
This is wrong. You know what I mean? Everyone else has a campus job. Everyone else can be paid by their school for doing stuff around the school that brings some sort of value in return to the school and still be a student. And it's fine. I always look at college sports and I'm like, why can't we do both? Why can't you be paid to play basketball and go to class? They're not really incompatible.
Well, I think the more interesting parallel, when I was in graduate school at North Carolina and I was doing a PhD program, my first year I was there, they paid me a stipend on top of tuition of $15,000. That's for 9 months. The second year they paid me a stipend of something like $11,000 over the course of the 9 months. The rationale for the stipend was the understanding that in order to put in the study necessary to truly do what you needed to in that program, mm-hmm. you weren't going to be able to get a job, and you were going to need money to live and a little walk around money.
Right.
So we wound up getting stipends. Now, for the stipend, 1 year I was a research assistant. The next year I was a teaching assistant, and I taught 3 recitations or so. Paid taxes on the money that I got made and everything else. I say that to say that it's not even like this isn't even like getting a job at a bookstore. This is like that. Part of why those stipends come, and some people were there and weren't on stipend, but it was a matter of competition. That's how you got better students, was you offered them better stipends.
Right.
This is exactly what people are suggesting that you could do with athletes that they absolutely refuse to do. But this is an option, and this is an option that is used already.
It's right, again, the rest of society has already figured this out. When people say it's like, well, you know, what's your plan? You know, if you change the system, it's all going to be chaos. You know what I mean? It's end times, whatever. It's like, what are we going to do? How are we going to figure this out? And it's like, well, we already have tons of different mechanisms at work that are are exactly the same. Like you said, you have a stipend mechanism. I saw Jay Billis on ESPN the other day talk about, well, what would happen if, you know, Andrew Wiggins, could have schools bid for services. And I was like, well, he would sign a contract with Kansas for 3 years and they would put in provisions, like, this is what we expect from you. Wiggins would negotiate what he expects in return. You know, and if the contract was broken, it would fall under contract law and you'd solve your dispute. We already have this system everywhere. We don't need to create a whole new system of oversight and governance for this. In fact, we should. I feel like we should just dismantle this NCAA system we have and let it just be like other things are.
Yeah, well, my other thing always is, and people say, well, what's your plan? I'm like, hey,
right, exactly.
You got a university full of people who can figure that out.
Right. Yeah, these are universities are billion-dollar businesses.
Yeah,
know? They're full of smart people.
Yeah, they act like Title IX is made out of titanium or something.
Right.
You got really smart people. I'm sure you guys have a law school. You can find somebody that can figure this out. Why are you looking at me?
Right. And then part of my point is always like the whole problem is that there is this centralized plan right now. Like, we're not really about that in America too often. Like, we sort of like to not have centralized plans. We don't want the Supreme Soviet deciding what everyone should get paid. You know, people always ask me, you know, when they always ask me about this, I always ask them, well, what do you do? You know, and they'll say, well, I'm a dentist. And I'll say, well, is there like a central, you know, dentist association office that sets the limit for what all dentists in America can be paid? And they look at me and they're like, no, that's insane. I'm like, well, why should college sports be different? It's not different for the coaches, as we talked about. It's not different for the administrators. And the NCAA tried to put pay limits on assistant basketball coaches. They got destroyed in antitrust court. Destroyed. They actually paid way more in damages than they thought they were going to.
Yep.
I want to get to the NCAA's statement reacting to the ruling from the labor board, because mostly it's hilarious, but I also want to get your response to it. First part of the statement, the NCAA is, this is great, disappointed that the NLRB Region 13 determined the Northwestern football team may vote to be considered university employees. I want to stop it there because, first of all, that's not even true. The NLRB did not determine that they may vote to be considered employees. They determined that they are employees and they could vote to unionize. So automatically the NCAA, and then, look, lawyers and PR people write this statement. It's not like the NCAA didn't understand a decision. This is just straight up, I wouldn't say it's spin, it's a straight up lie. They start off with a lie, which is classic NCAA. But it gets better. Next part. We frequently hear from student athletes across all sports that they participate to enhance their overall college experience and for the love of their sport, not to be paid. Again, this is not true. If you read the decision, they are paid. They're just paid with scholarships and it's price fixed. It's not a quote unquote free education. By the way, that term drives me insane. I know it has to bug you as much as it bugs me.
Yeah, just
the
shake
free education
it off.
Argument. It makes me blow up. I can't shake it off. I seriously, it's like scanners. Every time I hear it, poof, my head just blows up. I'm gonna read you a third part here. It gets back to something we were saying. Here's the NCAA. We want student athletes, 99% of whom will never make it to the professional leagues, focused on what matters most, finding success in the classroom, on the field, and in life. Yeah. Okay, for one, that sounds like a bad motivational speech and or a successories poster. But two, again, they make it sound like if you have money in your pocket, you can't learn. Like, if you're making money and going to school, like, you will never be a success. It's an impediment to finding success. The whole ruling shows that actually playing sports is probably an impediment to getting educated because it goes to what you said. There's only 24 hours in a day.
The thing I've learned about people associated with the NCAA.
Go on.
They only talk about this stuff with each other. Like, if you listen to the arguments and the things that NCAA people say with relation to this stuff, it is always the same tired arguments that have been destroyed for years. They only talk about this stuff with each other.
It's like an echo chamber.
Yeah. Yeah. But they are totally unprepared for the most basic of arguments.
Yeah, they really are. You know, have you seen the movie Schooled?
I have not seen it yet.
Okay, go see it. It's really good. It's basically the documentary based on the Taylor Branch Atlantic article. Really good. There's this amazing scene in the movie, right? It's great. Taylor Branch goes to, like, the National Convention of Athletic Directors, right? And they have them up there to speak as after his article comes out. By the way, I don't think any sports article in the last 10 years has been more influential. But that's probably for another podcast. Maybe I'll try to get Taylor on himself to talk about it. He goes up in front of these guys, and he's calling them out. He's calling them out like, you have to start out with people's rights and go from there. He's calling out, you know, your system is built on a lie, and it's going to crash down. I mean, the looks on their faces, it is like they've never heard this before. And, like, it's not that he's just come in and taken a turd in the punch bowl. It's like he's come in with, like, a giant hose and turned it on, and it's connected to a septic tank, and that's what's going into the punch bowl. I mean, it's amazing, their reaction. And I think it speaks to what you're saying, that they're not really listening to the outside world, and they do see themselves as this totally separate, like, I don't even want to say kingdom. I don't know what I even call it, this separate realm. That, again, the whole idea that, like, college athletes are somehow student athletes and so different than everyone else in society, and that college sports is so different than everything else we do. I think that, more than the racial stuff we talked about, maybe more than the economic stuff, I think that's almost the root of this, that this is somehow special and different when really it's not.
I think you're right.
Hey, that's the great answer.
Yeah. Hey, look, man. I know when what DB said has been said.
Let's go to the last question here. So I'm keeping you for a lot of time. If unionization does happen eventually, and again, there's all these hoops that has to go through. It may or may not happen. But if it did and it became widespread, what do you think the landscape of college sports would look like?
That is a good question, because here's the one thing about having a union of this setup. It will be a union of 18 to 23-year-olds.
You're right.
Which, while better than nothing, is still fertile ground for a lot of hilarity, if nothing else, right?
You know, it might. You know, if we look at what's kind of happened with the NFL union or the NBA union, and those are, like, you know, slightly older people that are part of the union, you might be about that.
I do think an advisor of some sort, like any other campus organization, would be very helpful to have. I will not patronize these young men and say that they are totally incapable of making this happen. However, I do recognize that there are hurdles of organizing any group of people, let alone the 18 to 23-year-old crowd. From there, I do think ideally you would see – well – I think you would see a separation of guys, depending on what the school is, because while the kids at Northwestern are saying that they want to make sure that their chance at an education is fulfilled and everything else, that's not a concern for everybody, because not everybody's enrolling actual students.
You're right.
You know what I mean? So it would be kind of interesting to see what it is and what different kids are conditioned to put up with based on how they grew up and everything else. There's really no telling exactly what the widespread thing would be. The one thing that you would see slash hope and understand is just the need for some collective voice of players and the idea that they don't just have to just put up with any old anything. And I do think that the people who are behind this are bright enough people and are connected enough people to not just throw this over to the wolves, right?
Oh, yeah, no. I mean, you would have to have like a Marvin Miller type. You'd have to have good staff, just like pro sports unions, the ones that are good do. And you would probably have to have the involvement of former players who are a little bit older, a little more life experience, who are really committed to this, and in some way are kind of selfless, right? Are sort of trying to think of what's best for everybody here.
Yeah.
If you had those elements, I think it could be pretty successful, and I think it could bring about a lot of good.
No, I agree. I mean, I don't see any, as much as the doom and gloomers come out on this, I don't see any way that people could look at this as anything other than a net positive for the players. And I can't see how any regular person roots for anything other than the players. Because if this is supposed to be about helping the players and educating the players, and all we're talking about in doing this with this particular union is things like medical care, how do you root against that? And there are people who are loudly rooting against it and don't realize that they're exposing their own hypocrisy in the process.
Like you said a minute ago. I got nothing to say. You're right. I totally agree with that. Well, look, Bo, we're pretty much short on time. Before we go, let the people know, and again, this is for you know, the small fraction of people that listen to this compared to people that already follow you on Twitter, but for people who don't, how can they find you?
Well, I am on Twitter at Bomani_Jones. It's BOMANI_Jones. I do a television show called Highly Questionable at 4:30 Eastern on ESPN2 with Dan Le Batard and the man who keeps us employed, Poppy.
Yep, that's 4:30 Eastern on ESPN2 for those of you who didn't hear the first time.
Yeah, we got that. I do Around the Horn from time to time. That's Monday through Friday, 5 o'clock Eastern on ESPN. And, I do a podcast, The Evening Jones. We do it live at 7:30 Eastern on Monday nights at theeveningjones.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at the iTunes store. You can also find it at Stitcher Radio.
Dude, you are so polished at this. I can tell you have practice. It's almost as if you have your own podcast and TV show.
Oh, yeah, shameless self-promotion is something I have a remarkably natural inclination for.
I feel like I'm learning from a master here. One last thing. This is a personal question a little bit, but what about writing? Are you going to see you doing more of that?
Yeah, I need to do more.
Do you have time? Like you said, there's only 24 hours in the day.
Yeah, and I just kind of need to do it. Me and writing kind of have an awkward relationship as a
Tell me about it. And I do it for a living. It's always awkward. Nobody has a non-awkward relationship.
I do plan to start doing more of that. This summer I've also got some more free time, so I hope to get to more writing, you know, substantial stuff, hopefully, assuming I don't get too lazy, because summer in Miami does not motivate you to work.
Does any time in Miami motivate you to work? I was just there last week. This is why I ask.
It doesn't motivate anybody to work. That's why it's the weirdest place I've ever been, because nobody here is really about working. Like, as a person who is a bit of a workaholic, being around a place where people are completely work-averse is just a little different.
Yeah, you could always come back to the Eastern Seaboard. I mean, the Northern Eastern Seaboard. We're all
workaholics.
Yeah,
I'm good right now, though. It's straight.
There's been a lot of snow this winter, are you sure?
Yeah, you guys go ahead and have the snowball fights. My arm is a little rusty.
I came out from Miami. We had snow yesterday in D.C. We had rain for 2 days straight, and then it started snowing. Are you sure I can't entice you with that?
Oh, dude, you guys caught the big L. The big L.
Yeah, it's been a rough winter, but hopefully spring is here. Bomani Jones, thank you so much for coming on. For Ruby Tuesday, I am Patrick Ruby, and as always, for Sports on Earth, I'm saying goodbye, Ruby Tuesday.